Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to 2024 and episode number 59 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, a very happy new year to you. Yes, it's a whole new year, 2024. Did you make any resolutions? I certainly did. In fact, my family and I all sat down together at the dinner table on New Year's Day and did it. Personally, I believe that there is immense power in speaking your intentions out loud. And in my experience, at least, the path from intention to reality is a pretty well-defined one. However, it always seems to begin with the consolidation of that intention through initially thought, of course, but then certainly through word. From that point onwards, you just have to take it a step at a time. Make each step an achievable goal, and before you know it, your words will have manifested there, right before your eyes. Anyway, thought for the day over, and back to today's show. It's a conversation I had with a gentleman by the name of Philip Karadjordjevic, also known as Prince Philip of Serbia. He's a former asset manager turned Bitcoiner, currently traveling the world, spreading the gospel of decentralized money with Jan3, which is Samson Mo's organization dedicated to promoting nation-state Bitcoin adoption. Along with all the Bitcoin chat, as you might expect, Prince Philip is also a monarchist. So in our conversation, you can expect his elevator pitch on why monarchy might be the best governance model going forwards. Let's see if Philip can convince you of that. And in the meantime, once again, Happy New Year to you, wherever you are. I wish you very good fortune for the coming 12 months. And don't forget to be very mindful of your intentions. The more concise they are, the better, in my experience. Let's all be the change we want to see in the world. Or, as Gandhi actually put it, little known fact, that isn't actually what he said. What he did say was, quotes, "We but mirror the world. All the tendencies present in the outer world are to be found in the world of our body. If we could change ourselves, the tendencies in the world would also change." Amen to that. And whilst you carry on pondering it, I would wholeheartedly suggest that for the first time in 2024, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Philip Karadjordjevic. Probably got a lot to say about is governance models.
It's a very boring topic.
Don't worry, mate. It's not that boring, actually, because I think a lot of people choose not to think about it, but it's not that boring. But I thought maybe we could talk about the ideas of monarchies.
It's not a boring topic when you think about it. I think it's a very crucial topic in this day and age. Sure.
And also, we probably have a number of anarchs who listen to this podcast. So hearing what a monarch might want is probably quite interesting for them. Also, Bitcoin adoption around the world.
Sure.
You know, what it's like, what happens.
Are we recording right now?
Yeah, there's no start or finish.
That's fantastic.
So maybe, first of all, can you introduce yourself?
Sure.
And currently what you're doing.
So I'm Prince Philip, hereditary Prince Philip of Serbia. Maybe you can also claim that my title's of Yugoslavia, because that's when it was last a functioning monarchy, and that was abolished in the 1940s. I am working now for Jan3. I'm a Bitcoiner. I guess you can call me a maximalist. and Jan3 is a Bitcoin technology and infrastructure company that was also working on nation state adoption and speeding up hyper-Bitcoinization. And started by Samson Mao.
And your previously your finance, is that right?
So yeah, my previous employment was in traditional finance, asset management at Lazard Asset Management for, I was working there for like almost 10 years.
And at Jan3, yep. Is it, I mean, I'm just going to guess because I don't know, but I get the feeling Jan3's got one of the goals at least means that you have to wander around governments, having meetings.
So yeah, that's the thing. We want to start conversations with, let's start again with this. Bitcoin is a bottom-up philosophy approach. That's what Bitcoin is. You'll never change that. But I think this is what Samson Mao wanted to, this is his idea, is that I think that bottom-up also needs a little bit of a hand from top-down. And it's beneficial if you can speak to leaders, to politicians around the world and educate them about Bitcoin. Not about them essentially adopting it, but to let them know that there's this bottom-up movement happening all around the world, and really they can't do anything about to stop it. So they might as well embrace it. And the sooner they embrace it, the better it is for them and the better it is for their people. So we let them know how Bitcoin benefits their populace, their citizens. And it does in many ways, from mining to using it as what it is meant to be used for, as a electronic cash, digital electronic cash, but also as store of value. Give all the arguments. But one interesting thing about trying to orange pill nation states is if they have energy, for example, one way to do it is that, you know, energy is money. You can mine Bitcoin, and that will make you money, and that money can go into projects. And that those projects can fund the infrastructure to make that mine, that energy grid, for example, better, or it can go to other projects. You can create Bitcoin bonds, local municipal bonds. Samson was the one who designed the volcano bonds in El Salvador. And this is a model that we're going to try use that in different ways and forms and introduce them in different countries. Like, for example, Costa Rica, they have a lot of hydroelectricity. And they have a lot of excess energy because of their rainy season, so they have a lot of water sitting at the top of the hill. Nowhere to go because they can't actually sell that energy anywhere else, but they can mine with it. So there's a few electricity plants who are actually mining Bitcoin in Costa Rica, and they are reaping the benefits of that. So we recently were in Costa Rica speaking to members of the government. And let them know that you can actually monetize energy and use that to pay for fixing roads, for example.
Well, I mean, and the rest. I mean, I've spoken to a number of people, even at this conference, who are using mining as a backbone to an industry or to a business model. Like, particularly, I'm thinking of Roatan in Honduras, where they're mining Bitcoin and the money is being spent on Bitcoin education. So the whole education program is funded by Bitcoin mining and nothing else.
I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And without the mining, they wouldn't actually be able to do the education program. So, but before I ask you about how all that's going a bit further, something's just struck me instantly that, yes, Bitcoin's a bottom-up movement. So how do you personally then, as a monarch, how do you personally marry those two things together? I obviously have an idea about what it means to be a monarch and what monarchs think and
technically believe. I'm not a monarch because there's not a functioning royal it's not part of the system in Serbia. So I'm just a member of the royal family. Of course, I'm going to try and pave the way for the monarchy to return in Serbia, but that's another subject.
Maybe, but why don't we start with that? Sorry to butt in. What is a monarchy, and why is a monarchy a preferred governance model?
Sure. Well, let's talk about monarchy in its purest form, absolute monarchy. And a monarchy is essentially a family who have who are the heads of the, who is the head of the monarch, the head of the family, the head of the state, who then it has to look after the generations to come. So succession is a very important part of monarchy, and that is leaving a future for your for generations to come. And the monarchy model is essentially saying that we are, they are the example of family values, traditions, and customs of that particular region, and they will are very interested in protecting their private property, but also ensuring that your private property is protected at the same time. They don't want it. If a monarch wants to last, he or she should not take from their people, not much from their people. They should be a very, they have to understand that they need to leave resources and assets for their generations to come. So if a successful monarch will be successful if he's good with the people, so they don't revolt and take him over. So in that way, monarchy allows for that freedom to happen. And it's very dead set on the idea of individual property rights. And this is where you can link it to Bitcoin.
What about though, so that's, I'm not even that au fait with the difference between, for example, absolute monarchy and what's another kind of monarchy? Okay, like what we've got in the UK?
Yes, though? Constitutional monarchy. When that's not really a monarchy. It's their figureheads, and this is the result of democracies becoming popularized, but still wanting to keep the idea of monarchy as well, because that adds, you know, example. And it's like it's a figurehead, and you still keep the tradition, the examples. It's tied to the church, and you know, people like that, and it's been in the UK. People like the sort of the glamour of the UK, of the British royal family. I mean, the whole world likes that. A lot of the world likes that. Not many people, but a lot of the world likes that. And but what that turns into is more of a like a celebrity culture style model, and kind of dependent on the press as well, and bringing in tourism and things like that. Which is, a monarchy can, in an absolute form, can do that. But I think the actual benefits of a monarchy are just completely taken away when it's attached to a democracy.
So in an absolute monarchy,
yeah. Okay, apart from one check, is that if in the UK the head of the monarch, so right now King Charles, does have a check on the government, but it's very rarely exercised. And it does add as a further check on the democracy, which is a step better than republics. So a constitutional monarchy is better than a republic. I will advocate for a constitutional monarchy over a republic any day of the week. So,
but an absolute monarch, who creates the rules and laws and et cetera in an absolute monarchy?
Well, he technically could, but you would want have a monarch. You would want to have a royal family that, yes, a monarchy is centralized, but you want to have a family and a structure that's decentralized. So you will want to have checks and balances within that royal family. So you will have advisors. You will have a council, a crown council, privy council, who will advise you how to set laws, how to go about navigating problems that are presented to you that come from your country. So unless you are a tyrant, you will listen to these because you want to last. You want to continue in your position. That's so you'll have to take advice, but obviously you have to choose good advisors. But then advisors will choose other advisors. So there's essentially good absolute monarchies will have good advisors and will know how to have checks and balances. And I think a good example of an absolute monarchy, not really an absolute monarchy, but of a model that's quite interesting, is that of Liechtenstein.
Or maybe, what about the UAE? I've been to the UAE a lot. Each of the emirates are basically family monarchs.
Yes.
You know, and obviously a lot, you could argue, people are happy with the way they're being.
Actually, that's living. Sorry, I could say that. Actually, that's another good example. I would say that in if you look in the Middle East, if you look at the different governance structures they have, they have there, you have a lot of absolute monarchies there, and you have a lot of republics there, democracies, and you can see the difference between them. The republics, democracies, are failing. they have wars, they have constant shifting leaders. Basically, they're just not having a good time. And all the monarchies, Jordan, absolute monarchy, doing pretty well. UAE, we just talked about right now, doing fantastic. Oman, pretty stable. Bahrain, doing pretty well, as far as I'm concerned. Kuwait, not bad. Saudi Arabia is an interesting one. Yes, it has poor human rights tied to it, but, you know, pretty stable as well. So
I think, well...
Then the other countries, Syria, not doing so well. Iraq, I don't think so. Iran, complicated. But that's sort of their governance is sort of different by the caliphate, where I always forget the name of their structure. But then you have Yemen, you have Syria, Lebanon. What other countries am I missing? But anyway, you get the picture. Those countries, not so good, sadly.
I was just thinking when you were talking about human rights violations. I think everyone gets accused of human rights violations, including even the monarchies in the Middle East. I think what seems to happen is the people who are part of the country, so that the mm-hmm. indigenous people seem to be very happy with monarchs. Sometimes outsiders coming in, work kids, this kind of stuff. That's where the human rights things happen. But is it am I right in saying then that the the benefit of a monarchy is that because you know you are definitely passing your crown on to your firstborn or whatever, mm-hmm. that you would think longer term. So unlike a democratic system where you get 4 or 8 years and then it could change completely.
Yeah, it's more about low time preference in a monarchy as opposed to democracies. Republics are very high time preference models. And yes, monarchy is not perfect, but it's a much better system than the democracy, one could argue. And I think Hans Hermann Hoppe, in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed, wrote a few chapters about this and makes a very compelling case, but he is not a monarchist, but he's saying that monarchy is the lesser of two evils. But yes, he's an anarchist, but given the choice, he will go over, he will choose monarchy over democracy any day.
What about yourself? What do you see the hierarchy of best solutions then to governance?
Well, if you want to look at the realistic picture, I'd say that returning to an absolute monarchy right now in Serbia is not going to happen. But I will argue and I will push for a constitutional monarchy, but with more checks and powers given to the monarch. It's coming rich from a member of the royal family trying to push for that, but I do see benefits in that. If it was really up to me now in an idyllic world, I would go so far as say that, yeah, I'm an anarchist as well, but I'm also an absolute monarchist. And I think both can exist in parallel, yeah, symbiosis.
How? What, in the same country?
Yes.
How? Explain that.
With a Bitcoin standard. As in I think in a pure anarchist society, I'm not an intellect over here, but this is me being idyllic and being, trying to find the happiest solution. But I think in a pure anarchist society, in a capitalist and cap society, what happens to cultures? What happens to traditions? What happens to customs? What happens to family values? And I think that needs some sort of centralization to protect that. And this is where religion comes in. And I think religion also needs a monarchy as well that goes side by side. And you'll find it hard to take religion away from a lot of people. And you'll find it hard as well to take also the idea of monarchy, that example, away from a lot of people as well. But I think monarchies in their pure form, where they let the people do what they want, but as long as they have their property and the people have their property, everyone is happy. And the church and the monarch are essentially the caretakers of tradition. It's it needs a lot of work, this model that I'm coming up with, but and it's never going to happen in our day and age. But I think there's some exploring that needs to be done down this.
I've never heard that theory before. So in an anarcho-capitalist society, because everyone is individuals,
yes,
you run the risk of losing a cultural identity.
Possibly.
Right.
I need to look into this more. But it's it makes sense.
Yeah,
these
yeah,
are just like, how would you call it? I haven't studied this much yet, but these are thoughts I've gathered in while speaking to people in general. And I know a lot of, I'll upset a lot of libertarians about this, but I believe that, you know, those libertarians, you have people are proud to be part of something. And you can never take away someone's identity. And I think that's super important. People want to belong somewhere. And yes, I think right now the structure of the world is that we have too much centralization. The countries have become too big, and I think there's the case for breaking up countries into smaller regions, and that will suit better. Like there'll be Liechtensteins of Europe. Will ideally be a bunch of Liechtensteins everywhere. But I would go a step further more and say, take away that direct democracy they have, and introduce pure an anarchist, but having that monarch still in place with the religion as the caretakers of tradition, customs, family values, and all that, and ceremonies as well.
I suspect ANCAP people will say that your theory is wrong, that
of course.
You wouldn't need an ANCAP society would retain culture without the need for a centralized authority to sort of caretake it, I suppose.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know, in all honesty. I'm just thinking to myself, my culture now, I would have called myself British for many years, and that seems to have dissipated, especially in the last 10 years, as my culture became what I was associating with online. And it's almost now become Bitcoin is the culture,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But we're arguably a decentralized group of people, but we know our culture, don't we? We know our Bitcoin culture. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you're doing. You know, you recognize a Bitcoiner, you share relatively similar ideals. I know a lot of people dispute that, but my experience of my subsection, I suppose.
Because in a way, we are forward thinkers, progressives, the right type of progressives. And but at the same time, I live in Serbia. When I moved back to Serbia 3 years ago, and culture there, the mind that in the individuals there are very much proud to be Serbs, nationalist in a good way. They're proud of their heritage. They're proud of their history. They're not proud of their democrat, sort of, let's say, socialist or communist history, but proud of their church, their identity, of the saints that make up what Serbia really is. And Serbia has been a monarchy for hundreds of more years than it has been a republic or socialist experiment.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of Serbia in the sense of the monarchy then?
Oh,
why,
sure.
What happened?
Well, Serbian monarchy, the first example of Serbian monarchy you have is from the 13th century, and that's the Nemanjić dynasty. And that was born in the area of Kosovo, and Stefan Nemanjić and his sons, a lot of them called Stefans, were also tied very much to the Serbian Orthodox Church. Some of them were like patriarchs of the church, as well as monarchs as well. And that was the birth of a lot of our culture from the Nemanjić dynasty. Then, fast forward a few years, a couple of centuries, the Ottomans then controlled our region. And we were living under, I guess, under the Ottoman Empire, enslaved by them. They allowed us to practice religion, but not openly. Our churches were like half underground. They allowed it to continue, but you couldn't ring church bells and all that, and it was quite oppressive. And then in 1804, my great-grandfather, great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Karadjordje Petrović, he is the one who started who organized the first Serbian uprising against the Ottoman Empire. And this was led, he got together in the area in Topola, in not Topola, sorry, in the Šumadija area in Orashat, he got together a group of about 300 men and sort of leaders, and he became the general and was picked as the leader to lead this movement because of his abilities to lead and also his abilities to make good, strong decisions. And he led this army that just, through great tactics, just started destroying the Ottoman control in that region. And all of a sudden, Serbia became, out of the Ottoman Empire map, the sea of the Ottoman Empire, you see all of a sudden, boop, Serbia just appears there because he liberated them. There was a second uprising again, led by the Obrenović dynasty. And so there was two dynasties, modern dynasties of modern Serbia. But Karađorđe is the one who's led the first one, and he's known as like the father of modern Serbia. The Obrenovićes were also ruling for some time, but they weren't as popular because they weren't really with their people so much. They weren't really hanging out with the locals so much, as the Karađorđević were always known to be like quite chummy. You know, they used to have dinners and meals and stuff, and whenever they travel, they stop at people's houses to have coffee, drink rakia and all that sort of stuff. Well, the Obrenović saw themselves a little bit more elitist, and because of that, I think Serbs didn't like that, and that's why the Obrenović were assassinated.
Really?
Yes.
By who?
By society.
Oh, right, okay.
Not by the Karađorđević, but then it was chosen that the King Peter the First would later get coronated, and he was chosen as the monarch of Serbia, and that's my great grandfather. He was chosen to lead the Serbs in getting away from the influence of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as the Austro-Hungarian Empire were growing very strong and very controlling. He managed to trying to move Serbia's industry and economic relations away from Austro-Hungary and have more relations with Russia and the West. And he managed to do this. And he was loved for this. Plus, he also was on the front lines in the First World War. He was a great leader. The best, after Karađorđe, he was the most liked Karađorđević, and probably one of the most liked Serbs in history. Up there with the Teslas. then his son, King Alexander the First, was the one who created Yugoslavia. But first it started as the kingdom of Serbs, Croat, and Slovenes. And this was in an effort to create a unity and a force against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as they were still trying to knock on our door and trying to, you know, encroach on our land. So that's why later then in Yugoslavia was then born after that, as he then united Bosnia and Montenegro and Macedonia all together to create Yugoslavia, and that was the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. And for a moment, in a beautiful moment in time, it was a very wealthy, rich, independent, you could call it small little empire, that was creating a lot of assets and people were doing quite well there. But then the idea of socialism or communism was always in the air, and that's when the Second World War happened. My great-grandfather, King Alexander, he was assassinated in 1934. First assassination caught on camera.
Really?
Yeah.
What, in the history of the world?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. A video,
yeah. He was caught. It was. It happened in Marseille. He was on his way. He went to visit France, and he met. You know, in France, he was received by the foreign minister, and as they were on their open horse carriage, he got assassinated.
Shot.
Yeah, by Croatian. It was apparently Croatian separatists. People who shot him, but I think there's more to the story, but I'm not going to go into a conspiracy with that.
There's always more to the story.
And then so he, his son, King Peter, my grandfather, well, I say King Peter, he was not old enough to become a king. He was only 12 years old when it happened. So his cousin, Alexander's cousin, Paul, became the regent king until Peter became of age. But this was towards the end of the 30s and now the beginning of the 40s when he became of age, King Peter, and then he became the monarch. But at that point, we were in the Second World War, and times were bad, and there was a big communist movement, ideology sweeping through Europe, and it captured a lot of the minds of the Yugoslavs, of the Serbs, the Yugoslavs in general. So you had the partisans, that was the communists, and you had the Chetniks, those are the royalists. And at some points against the outside threat, they were working together, but then they had to turn in on each other, of course, and it was pretty horrible. Both sides are guilty of some pretty horrible crimes. But one would think that the Brits and the American would choose the monarchists to support over the partisans. But no, of course not. The Brits and the Americans will choose the partisans and install and make sure that that socialist model, that socialist Yugoslavia would be a thing, because that was easier to control than an independent monarchy. And not many people know this, that Yugoslavia did 60% of its trade with the West and the rest with the East. I mean, it was open. It was playing both sides. That's because the Americans wanted that. It was their way to have some sort of leverage towards Russia. And Tito enjoyed this. And he lived better than any king. He lived like a proper emperor, king. Like, he really, really took what he wanted and had 30 or 40 villas. Not just my family villas that he stole, but all the other aristocracies that villas and property that he stole. And he was living like, and you say living like a king, he was living like a god.
How does that work? What happened to all your property then?
So that was...
Was it literally stormed and then people...
So during the Second World War, there were storms. You know, the Germans were passed by, the Russians passed by, but then at the end of the day, they ended up in the control of the communists.
Everything.
And they created a confiscation act against the Karo Georgievich dynasty, of the confiscation, but it's basically stolen acts. Confiscation Act is self-explanatory. And that act still exists today.
Really?
Yes. And that act was part of the Yugoslav constitution. It's now part of the Serbian constitution. But check this out. Slovenia, which has, we have property there as well. Slovenia, where's Slovenia now? In the EU. And they still have, when they were allowed into EU in 2004, they have a clause in their constitution, which is basically taken from the Yugoslav constitution, made their own, that's still against the Karadjordjevich family, that confiscation act. And that is a direct violation of human rights, according to Brussels.
Is that because Is that so that they never have to hand back property?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. No other reason.
No, it was just, you know, EU wanted to rush the idea of the EU, expand it as quickly as possible. That clause is no one's going to do anything about that. But no, that's shouldn't be there. If you want to be in the EU, you don't have a clause like that, but it's still there. So that shows a lot about what the EU is about. It's not really about individuals. It's more about expansion.
Yeah. I think that makes sense to me. So did you lose everything?
Everything.
Everything. And you've never got anything back?
Nothing.
That's interesting.
My father lives in the palace in Belgrade, but it's still state-owned.
Really?
Yeah, with a budget, a very minor budget. And this is where people think, oh, yeah, he's a parasite. People pay for his lives and stuff. But, yeah, well, not for his lives. He has to make his own money and stuff. But the budget, which is a very minor budget, goes to the maintenance and upkeep. I don't live in the palace. I live downtown with my wife and my son. I have issues with my stepmother. I won't go into those details. And in that respect, I think I'm more with my people right now if I live downtown, and I think I want to earn the right to live in the palace.
Set the scene in Serbia itself then. Like, are you well known? Does everyone kind of know you and your father? And, you know, is it something people talk about, monarchy and democracy and all these kind of things? Mm.
So the Karadjordjevich dynasty is like known by everyone, because that's Karadjordje. It's should be taught in history, even though there was a lot of revisionist history happening during the communist years where they said that the Karađorđević, Karađorđe was the one who liberated the us from the Ottoman Empire, blah, blah, blah. Great, you know, King Peter, great. Alexander, not so great because he created Yugoslavia, but, you know, and that, well, not so great. They don't tell people that he created Yugoslavia. Sorry, but that now, since Yugoslavia is, it's disappeared, they'll blame Alexander Karađorđević and not the communists for destroying the idea. So anyway, they'll teach in school that my grandfather left the country in a train full of gold. Yes. So they'll teach people there. So quite a lot on social media, you get people commenting like, yes, where's the gold? Where's the gold? Where's the gold? Like that. It's like, yeah, if I knew, I wouldn't be in my position right now. but Karađorđević today is recognized. My father's highly recognized, and I've done a big job to try and put myself on the minds of people, because I'm trying to talk about people's problems, and I'm trying to give them a platform to elevate their issues. Because right now Serbia has a pretty tyrannical government. I mean, most of the West does now at the moment. We can argue that. But Serbia has had a very strongman leader.
Which way do they lean currently?
Wherever.
Political.
Left, right, wherever they choose.
Is it?
Left. Well, they are still the generations of the younger generations of the communists that were still in power. So communism is still there. It's just an elitist. The elitists have just continued holding on to that power. And the politicians are all part of that club. Not all of them, but most of them, the ones in power. They haven't changed. A lot of them have just changed their political views a little bit, but they're still there. Hmm.
What about the situation, like, for example, we have in the UK where the royal family are well known, you know, if... They're like celebrities, so they'll be on telly every now and then, and they'll do this or they'll do that. Is it like that for you, mm-hmm. or is that something you're trying? Like you say, you're trying to.
Well, we're recognized. My wife and I are recognized as opposition,
and that's the only opposition, or
no. Well, yeah, at the moment one of the only opposition, but no, there's a lot of other. Politicians and some activists are known in the opposition, people who are actually brave enough to speak out against the problems of society. I don't actually name the president and his regime as the causes of these problems, but it's pretty obvious. And yes, what was the question? Sorry.
Nothing. I was just, I'm trying to get this, set the scene. I'm trying to understand.
About appearing on TV and stuff. I have an issue where I don't speak Serbian properly. I'm still learning. Because my father was born in exile, 1945, in London. And he married my mother. She is a Brazilian princess from the Orleans Braganza family. And they had three sons, my older brother, myself and my twin brother. I'm the oldest of the twins. And my father, his father was, thanks to the abolition of the monarchy, fell into personal issues, you know, alcoholism, and he died from liver disease at a very young age. My grandmother died in 1993, slightly older age, but very bitter of all the things that happened, you know, the family destroyed. They continued destroying the family after they left. The best thing that they did was that they didn't kill us, but they sent a secret service to try and destroy us further by introducing lovers to my grandfather and things like that. So
really,
pretty dirty stuff. But here we are today.
What you're alluding to now is one of the problems of monarchy, which is. What happens when you get a bad monarch?
That's a good question. That's one of the issues of monarchy is when you get a bad monarch. What happens when you have a bad monarch? Well, hopefully that's the solution to that is having that decentralization we're talking about and having that advisory body who can take power away from the monarch and maybe choose a different member of the family or ensure that certain rules can't be broke, that the monarch can't break, and that he, you know, so you have some checks there.
How do you do that, though? I mean, it no longer becomes a monarchy at that point, isn't it? The more you, I don't know. But I haven't thought it. I thought it through deeply enough to even have a position on this. But personally, I like the concept of anarchy. Obviously, it seems very natural to be in control of your own life. But on the other hand, I can understand that there's a scale at which centralization does seem to work as well. I think as you go too far, it gets wrong, and it disrupts and it destroys. But at certain scales, it does work. So maybe that, like you said, solution is smaller places.
Smaller places and on a Bitcoin standard, because that essentially you can't have too much. A monarch will not have the ability to overprint money, steal assets.
Yeah, and they'd have to earn the money, basically.
Exactly. And so if you do get a bad one, a bad fruit, then hopefully you would have the checks and balances to control that bad fruit and maybe even get him out and then choose someone else in the family. So this is something to be discussed and something I need to look into further as well. I think there's, you know, as Hopper says, it's not perfect, but it's still a lesser two evils. And I would say, okay, I would prefer it to be an absolute monarchy an absolute monarchy, but with the Bitcoin standard and an anarcho-capitalist society has something there that we need to explore. But I think that's another conversation when I've done my homework.
That's a conversation when we observe what's happening over the next 20, 30, 40 years. I think because a lot of what's happening now is an experiment, and Bitcoin is an experiment, and we all think we know what the results of a Bitcoin standard would be, but in all honesty, we don't actually know. These are human actors acting out of, you know.
But essentially, if you have an asset that's incorruptible and it's your private property and it can't be censorship resistant, and it's a way of protecting your property, and you can finally start investing and saving. And you focus on yourself first, and you create wealth for yourself and your family, and at that point you're comfortable, then you will that individual will then have a lower time preference and start doing better things, won't be under such pressure to make money now and to survive in an inflationary society, and instead he'll be doing things that have more meaning and longer lasting effects in society. So by that alone, he becomes an example and almost like a good that other people can replicate and copy. And he will be, you know, these people will also benefit the more high time preference individual, the more individuals that are into instant gratification, they will stand to benefit from people that are really focused, like Bitcoiners, and people who are into creating wealth so they will create jobs, higher paying jobs, and then these people will then have access to more higher paying jobs, incomes will go up, and so those high time preference players will benefit without knowing it. And they will then learn about this low time preference behavior, and then they'll learn more about something like Bitcoin and savings and stuff, and they'll have families and do proper low time preference activities.
Well, arguably, yes, the incentive will be to be low time preference.
The incentive should be low time preference. And sadly, in the world that we live in with this fiat money, it's forcing people to become high time preference actors. And this is what's causing the death of civilization around the world. And it's giving birth to some horrible movements around the world, mainly in the West, I'd say. These, where we've gone into this dark and crazy idea of gender politics and identity. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we should go down that route, but you understand.
Well, a lot of people say it's end of a civilization stuff.
Yes, end of civilization stuff, because, I mean, that wouldn't have happened under a gold standard. But the gold standard was what led to the fiat standard. But now fiat standards, what leads to a Bitcoin standard. So
I was just thinking about it as you were speaking then. I think one of the problems that monarchs, or the monarchistic, if that's the word, system has, is even in the word monarchy. I think everyone, if people want to kind of, you know, push those ideas, I reckon it's better to change the word even, because the word monarchy has such negative connotations.
It has negative connotations, and it's closely, and that's the sad thing, it's closely linked to, like, a monarch is like a dictator. Hmm. When it couldn't be, I think there's overlaps, but
it's more like monarchs are people who get free money from the blue collar people pay money to the great monarch, and they don't really do much. That's the general meme, I suppose, if you're an anti monarchist,
And that really is something that doesn't do anything as part of a constitutional monarch, like the British royal family. That's why there's a lot of hate towards them. Yes, you can argue that the British royal family is an investment for tourism, and they'll bring back X amount indirectly through tourists visiting around the world, because there's a functioning monarchy there. But then people argue, okay, well, even if there wasn't a monarchy there and it was abolished, those assets that they have, the properties and stuff, are still there to be visited. But then people will argue, well, actually, no, but if there's no monarchy that people don't want to visit, think that they'll go to England to actually get a glimpse of, not the Queen anymore, but to get a glimpse of Prince William and Kate and Prince Charles.
Well, in France, obviously, people still go to visit France, and their monarchy will be added.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I think there is some merit to that argument, yes. But it doesn't mean that it disappears suddenly if the monarchy vanishes and tourists just stop coming to the UK.
No. But you'll lose that sort of little magic there.
It's surprising how many people are still very into the monarchy. And even after, I mean, the most egregious thing, I don't really care about a monarchy. You know, I don't think either way of it. But I do notice, for example, when, you know, the Queen gave a speech, I forget how many years ago it was, when, you know, one of her sort of yearly speeches where she talked about austerity.
Yes.
And it was famously, you know, she was adorned in gold, sitting on a gold throne, you know, blah, blah. That kind of stuff does rile me a little bit when I think, oh, God, shut up, you know.
I agree. That riles me as well.
Yeah.
That's not something I would practice.
But that, and I have actually met, well, a number of members of the royal family. I worked in Fleet Street, and part of my job was often to go to events, and I never found any of them that particularly nice. I found them very elitist, obviously.
Yeah.
But it has such a PR problem.
I couldn't agree more.
How do you sell monarchy to the people of Serbia then, if you want to?
Because I actually care about the people.
No, how? How? Yeah.
Yeah,
like, how, no, how, how do you sell what's it? The feeling? What's the general feeling amongst Serbians, for example?
Well, I would say maybe 30-40% would want the monarchy to come back, because it's better than what they're having right now. Maybe 30-40% are indifferent, and the rest, obviously, would hate it. But how to sell the idea is, as you talked about the issues of monarchs today, like the British royal family being very elitist. I agree. I'm not friends with the British royal family. I think they're too elitist. I think they live in another universe. I myself like being downtown. I like going to the market. I like hanging out with people. I like having meals here and there and joking around. And I wish I could speak Serbian better, but I'm improving that. My wife, she's Serbian, and, you know, she's pretty down to earth, I believe. Our son, his mother tongue is Serbian now, which is fantastic. The first male Kara Djordjevic to have mother tongue of Serbian since like almost 100 years. And he goes to local nursery, and, you know, we're out there, we're living, you know, we go to the park, we're living like normal people, I guess. Well, I mean, what's a normal person? But, you know, we're there doing that thing. We're just focusing on ourselves, trying to eat well.
Do you mix with any other royal families?
Or? Not so much.
Who are the cool ones then, as you say? Who are the non-elitist ones? Or is there anyone, any other royal family where you can just go and have a beer and shoot the shit and not get...
I know a lot of... aristocracy and German aristocracy that some of them are really cool. I know some of them, like I'm friends with Jean-Christophe Napoleon, basically, and he's the head of one of the pretenders of the French throne. He married one of our family members, distant cousin, who's of Austrian, the Arco family of Austrian monarch, and they're pretty down to earth. They're pretty cool. I really like them a lot. I was at their wedding with my wife in 2019. They were just now at my sister's wedding in Spain. My mother remarried a Spanish duke. And I got two half-sisters, and the eldest of them, Sol, got married last week. No, where are we now? Saturday? Last Saturday. Oh. Yeah. Other cool ones I would say that I met in the past was the former king of Jordan, King Hussein. He was loved by his people. Funny story, actually. I forgot who told this to me, but he wanted to want to understand how much people loved King Hussein, and prove that the absolute monarchy there actually it works quite well, because people there are fine and happy there. They go about their lives. Maybe they won't be as technologically rich as other nations and stuff, but they are happy because they're free. So he went into a taxi and started bad mouthing the king. The taxi driver stopped the taxi and pulled out a knife on him.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So I guess there's that. Because he was really loved. He was really loved. Other monarchs I've met. I recently met. I was recently in Liechtenstein, and I met and had a few minute conversation with the former head. Well, he is still the head of the family, but he gave over his duties to his son. But I met Prince Hans Adam II. He's the one who wrote the book Millennium in the Third. The State in the Third Millennium. Quite a revered book by
what's it about? I don't know.
How to sum it up? It's quite libertarian.
Is it how to govern in
how to govern?
Right.
Okay. Quite libertarian. Of course, with some centralization aspects like of the monarchy, but in a libertarian mindset. So similar to what I'm trying to preach right now. Well, I'm not preaching, sorry, I'm trying to discover right now. But he writes about the ills of centralization around the world, the ills of huge charities that pretend to do good, these
NGOs
and things like that, and you know, all these so-called, what's that word, altruist.
What's that?
Altruist.
Altruism.
Effective altruism and things like that.
Yeah, so very ineffective.
Very ineffective. And he writes about the ills of that, basically. I haven't read the book, but it's a famous book. But I had the opportunity to meet him and chat to him, very down to earth, you know, holding on to his beer, having a good laugh and stuff. And, you know, we had a good chat. He seems like someone you want to hang out with.
Hmm.
For obvious reasons, he's loved. He's very much loved.
Right. Okay. So, can we talk a little bit about the Bitcoin side of things then? Because, like I say, you now work for Jan 3, which is so called because it was founded on January the 3rd. Is that right?
No, it's just taking the name from January 3rd, 2009.
Oh, is that when the white paper came out?
No, that's the first block.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Paper was 31st of October 2008.
Okay.
Yeah.
So first block mined on Jan 3rd.
Yeah. And okay. That's when, you know, the Times article, Chancellor of the Exchequer, yes. Banks are on the brink of second bailout.
Yes, second bailout for banks. Second, you know, bailout. What? The original copies of that Times newspaper now,
yeah,
are going for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Are you serious?
Yes. And I had a really interesting discussion with someone the other night who said, because I know this is true, like when I was a kid, a lot of our mums and dads used to get the Times.
Yes.
And they never used to throw them away. They used to put them in the garage and stack them up.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Now, imagine if you could find one or two of those. There must be people with loads of Timeses in their garage. And
Some of them.
Another thing is, you look for people whose birthday is January the 3rd, 2009, because a lot of people used to buy the Times on that day and get it framed and just say, look, you know, do you want to sell it? I'll give you.
There's a lot of people out there who probably have that Times without realizing the significance of it.
Yeah, I looked on, someone told me about it a while ago. I looked on eBay and it's true.
I never thought about the actual original. Are you serious? $100,000?
There was one on eBay. I mean, it wasn't selling, so I don't know whether it has sold, but it's a real thing. And you know, I saw you in El Salvador, and did you get a copy of the paper from El Salvador on Bitcoin Day?
No, but our office in El Salvador has both copies of Bitcoin Day.
Oh, you've got an office in El Salvador?
Yeah.
Jan 3 have got an office.
And then in that office, we have the two papers, the one when they announced the law and the one when it was enacted. Yeah.
Arguably, they won't be as popular.
No,
but still
that's
good.
History.
Yeah.
That's history. It's the first country of adoption. So that's history.
I bought one back myself. They were giving them out at the first Lightning conference. First one. Yeah, I just took one. Fortunately, I kept it flat. I put it in a cardboard sleeve and actually kept it flat, because the problem with things like that is they just get annihilated. Yeah, but I haven't framed it yet. I was going to wait and see.
See, I had a copy of when the Times, but I don't know where it's gone, of 9/11.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And I thought that was quite one to keep. But I was intelligent enough to keep.
Oh, you didn't? Oh.
No, of course.
I was working on 9/11, and I was a photographer at a national newspaper in London. And I was on a flight. I was boarding a flight as the towers came down from Barcelona to the UK. We were one of the last flights to come in. But interesting story, completely off topic here, but we were at a... it's an event called Visa pour l'Image, which is like a big gathering of photojournalists in the south of France once a year. And all the main well-known photojournalists go there. And a number of them have just flown out the morning before to arrive in New York at 8 a.m. And they did. And most famously, James Nachtwey, who took some of the most iconic pictures. Basically,
really?
Got off a plane at 8 o'clock in the morning in New York and walked straight into it. You know,
wow.
But it's very unlikely that so many famous photojournalists would all be in this one place in the south of France, and a lot of people couldn't get home. You know, I got a photo of the TV in the airport, and everyone gathered around the TV watching the towers come down. You know, it's like quite an amazing.
That's a very
event.
Strange point in history.
Very strange.
Very strange.
I mean, a pivotal point in history.
Pivotal point in history. Yeah.
I'm not even sure we really understand the difference between pre and post 9/11, because many of the authoritarian tendencies that we see now
happen afterwards.
Yeah.
That's what started. I mean, you could argue it was 1971 that started it, but I'd say the most pivotal was 9/11. That's when you started really seeing your freedom being taken away.
Well, also I was a photojournalist then, and my whole life was immersed in that visual imagery world, and I found myself getting hypnotized by this thing in the same way that people went pretty crazy during COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but in 9/11 it was more intense. It was literally like drip. It was like pumping out images of death and fear through the telly constantly. Do you remember they just played it over
fear.
And over and over? It was almost like I don't think I could say this thing was a conspiracy. There probably are aspects of it that are a conspiracy. But when you look at it, it was very much a holy shit, look at what's going on here. If you just arrived on planet Earth and you saw what was happening that day, and everyone glued to their screens just seeing this images over and over again of people jumping out of windows, explosions, you know, and people were mesmerized by it.
I know.
You would conclude that something was going on.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
it was like group hypnotism or something.
Well, yeah, and that's why I think.
Well,
I think some of these conspiracies are quite true, but
that's for sure.
That's another conversation.
It is,
and I think COVID was just another and a continuation of that. But the enemy is obviously the one that you definitely can't see. Yeah. The terrorism's never, you know, terrorists. They appeared every now and then, but there wasn't the threat that they really said they were. Well, but people living under the constant fear of that threat, of that attack, is you can make them do so many things.
Have you noticed in your work with Jan 3 that you're coming up against the opposition at all yet?
Not properly yet, but we are trying to start conversations and meet with politicians, presidents, prime ministers around the world. And we can only really get an introduction, I mean, a meeting to talk about Bitcoin if that individual is open to talking about it.
Right.
So that sort of eliminates most of the world.
Does it?
Yeah.
Most of the world?
Most of the world won't, politicians will not get, will not, well, first things first, I'm maybe not big enough. Samson's not big enough to call a meeting with, like...
But who,
like,
else is there? I mean, who else do they call? Michael Saylor?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, who else, really?
But the thing is, are they interested to talk about Bitcoin?
Well, that's the question.
That's the question. If they are, hell yeah, we'll go in there and speak to them. But right now, we're seeing that is happening in some countries, like Costa Rica. We were there recently. We spoke to a very, very high-level politician there. We can't reveal it because it was meant to be a secret meeting. I was recently in Liechtenstein speaking to them about Bitcoin. Samson was in the Senate, did a presentation in the Senate of Mexico. There's a lot of closet Bitcoiners in the political system there, but one of the open ones is Senator Indira Kempis, and she's a very open Bitcoiner. She's a great person that gets Bitcoin, and she's trying to push for it out there.
What about what's going on in El Salvador currently with you guys? You've got an office.
We've got an office there.
Is that in the Bitcoin department or whatever it's called?
In the Bitcoin city?
No, yeah. They've created a Bitcoin, what do you call it? Within the government now. There's a building.
Of course. No, it's not there.
No, it's different.
It's different. But they have that, what's it called?
Max and Stacey.
Yeah, it's Max and Stacey. Yeah, it's a Bitcoin, anyway, I forget
it's
what
a
it is.
It's like a political office almost. Yeah.
I think we're part of that association. I forget.
But you were part of the production or the whatever, the evolution of the volcano bonds, right?
No, Samson was. That was pre-Jan 3. That was in 2021 when Samson designed the volcano bond.
What's going on? Maybe describe what they are first, because a lot of people won't. What was a volcano bond?
So to put it simply, which is the only explanation I can probably give you... is it's a financial instrument like a bond, similar to a bond. So you would, say, raise $1 billion. $500 million will go to buy the thing, which is Bitcoin. The other $500 million will go into infrastructure to create the geothermal energy that will then ultimately mine Bitcoin. And the bond will have like a 6-year maturity. And every year you would pay the Bitcoin part is that you bought, that's what will be paid at the end with maturation. But the coupons are paid like a 6% coupon from the mining operations of the geothermal volcano.
Right. So they-
and that will then the money as well is reinvested as well into infrastructure to improve that geothermal mining and create more geothermal mining projects to make El Salvador more sovereign, more energy independent.
Which, I mean, they have proven, I suppose, recently, yes. Because they have recently spurned advances from the world, from the World Bank to fund their infrastructure.
And they're paying back their debts and stuff. And they were recently given an upgrade on their credit rating by one of the big raters, I think Standard & Poor's, maybe, was it Fitch, or I don't know, one of those guys.
So volcano bonds are bonds issued by the government which are backed by Bitcoin, and they pay partly for new Bitcoin mining infrastructure which creates more Bitcoin. Which helps pay back the percentage, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The bond was structured, was engineered during a different market when interest rates were lower, the price of Bitcoin was higher, and maybe the hash power was not as high as it is today. So that model might not work as much as well today, but it just needs to be tinkered with a little bit. And
they haven't been released yet?
No, not yet.
Do you know when they are?
Soon. And these bonds will be released on Liquid Sidechain, Bitcoin Liquid Sidechain, which will allow for these sort of securitizations. to happen, which allows liquid Bitcoin liquid sidechain is something to, technology built on Bitcoin that I think it's underappreciated these days. That came about, I think, 2015 as well, or 16.
It's Adam Beck's company.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and that's what Matt Samson wanted to take away with him is the wallet Aqua. That's what we're going to release in Jan 3, and it's going to be a Bitcoin centric wallet, but with USDT on Liquid, and we feel that Liquid is going to be playing an important part in that transition from traditional legacy finance to a Bitcoin standard. You can really bridge both them with Bitcoin Liquid. So I think there's good things to come for Bitcoin, but it's not the cool kid on the block yet.
Well, interestingly, I overlooked Liquid for a while until recently, because at the Free Cities Foundation, we've been obviously reaching out to a lot of intentional communities and self-sovereign communities around the world. And what you notice is many of them are structuring their community on a blockchain, not Bitcoin. And the reason they're doing that is because they can, for example, issue NFTs as deeds on land, and they can create their own stablecoin, and they can use tokens to tokenize things, etc., etc. And up until recently, I always thought you couldn't do that on Bitcoin, but as it turns out, Liquid as a sidechain,
you can do
all
that.
It's a place where you can anchor it to
you can do NFTs, you can do securitizations, everything on Liquid. Yeah. Anything you want. It's in a way, it's the programmability of Liquid. It's beautiful. I don't understand it fully. I'm not technical. I'm not a developer, but I'm speaking to a lot of people who get it, and it excites me. So it's going to be as big as Lightning. There's going to be Liquid, and it's going to be Lightning. Lightning has its drawbacks, but so does Liquid at the moment, but both can be improved. And I think Liquid will have its day soon.
I had a big conversation here on the Blockstream stand with someone about all this, and it's opened my eyes now. I have a new avenue to go down to try and work out if you can, how easy and how well and what the trade-offs are to structure a community on Liquid.
On Liquid?
Instead,
you can structure a society on the Bitcoin standard using all the layer solutions. It's all there. You can do it all on Bitcoin. It's beautiful. As Michael Saylor spoke yesterday, he cemented that idea. Well, not cemented, but sorry, I say cemented? No. He
reinforced. Touched,
reinforced and on that idea that, you go into Bitcoin and you think, or you see something you don't like about it, instead of going off and trying to start another thing that's trying to be better than Bitcoin, which will eventually fail, no, you should do the hard work and improve that part of Bitcoin or create another layer solution on Bitcoin. Because at the end of the day, Bitcoin is the one that won't fail. It's the most secure. It's the one that actually works. And all the other stuff is just...
Well, it's the most censorship resistant one, which I think...
The most.
I don't think people necessarily... Well, Bitcoiners definitely know this, but I think your general population doesn't understand the importance of the decentralized aspect of Bitcoin.
They don't.
Because without it...
They don't appreciate it.
You've got nothing.
Or they don't understand it, as you said. That's why you say, I don't think much of Bitcoin, but I think blockchain technology is really, really going to take off. But really, what is blockchain technology without Bitcoin, without proof of work?
Oh, yeah,
really, it's just a glorified database after that.
Correct. I think
the most important part of Bitcoin is the proof of work. It's the mining. I mean, it's like, all in call it mining. Satoshi Nakamoto never mentions mining in his white paper. He calls it time stamping.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. You're just you're making records of truth.
It's another word that needs to be overhauled.
Yeah, time stamping.
That sounds
time stamping truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a very much. So, another project I know a little bit about is Madeira. Were you involved in that?
No, Samson was a little bit involved with that. But I've got a story.
Okay.
That I was involved in the conversation of Michael Saylor, orange pilling. Well, a masterclass of my Saylor, laser eyed focus, orange pilling session for breakfast at his villa.
Oh, this is at Bitcoin 2022.
Yeah, last year at his villa.
With Princey.
Princey to my left. Saylor to my right, Princey to his left.
Yeah.
No, sorry. To his right.
Okay.
And Saylor, laser-eyed, president of my day at the other side of his breakfast table outside, and just going on for about 45 minutes to an hour about Bitcoin and linking it to other amazing stories. I wish I had it on record. And it was beautiful. And so I got to hang out with the president of Madeira at that time, and his entourage of two really nice guys. And I like the president of Madeira. What's his name? What's his name? Sorry.
I don't know.
Anyway, he gets it. But, you know, he's still a bit fiaty. He's a politician, but he gets it. And right now they're going to be going for re-election later this year. So he's not going to talk about it so much. But after he gets re-elected, which he will, then they will really move forward more with Bitcoin adoption there.
I heard that same story from Daniel Prince. And I have to say, like, he's a super hard-working Bitcoiner, isn't he?
One of the hardest.
Because the whole reason the president of Madeira flew out to Miami was basically because Princey just spoke to him.
It was actually not thanks to Andre.
Yeah.
Andre and Princey. And Andre is the Madeiran Bitcoiner, Maxi, who orange pilled the president and got him on the plane. But obviously Princey is one who facilitated that. And also that was happening at the same time when I became public about Bitcoin. And this is where Daniel Prince was one of my mentors in getting me into the space, and he just like put me under his wing. I was on his podcast. The first podcast I ever appeared on was his podcast. Yeah. It was fantastic. And he introduced me to a lot of people, and we flew out together, and me, Andre, and Daniel Prince stayed in our, in an Airbnb together. Yeah. And we'll have memories there that we'll never forget of the news, things that happened, me getting offered Giant 3 job, breakfast at Sailors and all this sort of stuff, and just all these funny stories that happened on the side of the conference. It's a very memorable moment, a very memorable time, that last April.
That was also the time after, probably the first time after lockdowns, that people started emerging back out.
Yeah, exactly.
The world,
after
it?
All that bullshit started to close, you know, to open up again, when they realized that that's not going to last. I was having difficulty trying to get certain certificates together.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who found themselves in a similar position.
Yeah,
they seem to rectify the problem somehow. Okay, well, what else haven't we talked about? Have you got any other aspects of your life? Like, I'm picking up on the two main things, the monarchy thing and the Jan 3 thing. Maybe there's probably more to be spoken about Jan 3. Are there any other countries that you haven't mentioned that, or where, like, do you sit down and strategize about
this?
Yes,
of course.
And where, are you heading towards Africa or Southeast Asia?
We strategize, and what we do is because we use bottom up to help us with our top down. So we reach out to people. People reach out to us, say, hey, Jan 3, we need your help to orange pill so-and-so. We've got a meeting with that. Can you come and join that and stuff? So there's people happening. Bitcoin is doing that sort of groundwork, and either they do it by themselves, whatever, but sometimes they say, hey, Jan 3, can you help us with this? So we have lots of Telegram groups with a lot of amazing individual maxis around the world. And so we got like conversations happening in Norway, in Switzerland, in Liechtenstein, we got groups for, what else? Panama. We have also conversations happening in, some in Colombia, in Peru and Ecuador. So there's all these things, and there will be more. And we're reaching out, you know, like right now I'm thinking it's a really good idea to reach out to Norway. I want to get meetings in Norway. Norway, not part of the EU, tick, excellent. Currency falling right now. It's been dubbed Norgentina. Norgentina, sorry. Argentorway. Okay. Yeah. their fiat project is going under, losing a lot of value. Problem is with Norway, cashless society, they're going towards that. People are tipping them off to be one of the first adopters of CBDCs. But okay, bad. But take the fact that if they're cashless, they'll understand that that's taking away a lot of the freedoms, and you have issues with depositing cash and all that bullshit that goes with that. But That means if you teach them about Bitcoin and say that doesn't really concern Bitcoin, that's one way to teach them. But what I'm also, Norway also is energy rich. Apparently the south of the country is energy expensive, but the north of the country, cheap energy. So mining there.
What are the main ideas you take into these meetings? Because you can't really sell Bitcoin as a currency, really.
So I think
it's too volatile, right?
You know, I think the thing right now is to sell them as a mining operations. And yeah, you can sell them as a currency, but that's another side. That's another thing. But I think right now, talking about mining is one of the best things, and creating bonds. From a national level, like a volcano bond structure, which we're trying to talk to with Costa Rica doing hydro bonds, for example. But then to even local structures, you can have municipal bonds, a slightly smaller scale. And this is where I think a lot of adoption will happen.
What about reserves?
Yeah,
do you tell them to get reserves as well?
Yeah, well, that's another thing, is to try and speak to companies and try to speak to people to say, look, get your reserve assets, buy some Bitcoin, because that's your bet, your hedge against the current system failing. You know, it's your insurance policy.
Do you find that people in those worlds think there might be a collapse of the system? Like, a lot of Bitcoiners pontificate.
Yeah.
Do normal people think that we're in dire straits or not?
It depends where in the world you are. I think in the more financially privileged part of the world, no. I don't think they're aware of what could happen. But in my part of the world, in, let's say, Serbia, where I am, I think people there, where there's less distrust for the government, and interesting, they're less brainwashed, which was the reverse maybe 40 years
less
ago.
Less trust or less distrust? Less trust for the government.
Less trust for the government.
Right.
So they know that the system could fail at any point because they've experienced the third highest hyperinflation in the world. They know that could happen.
When was that?
The 90s.
Is that right?
Yeah, pretty bad.
Were you weren't
no,
in
no,
and
no,
out
I,
then?
No. We weren't really allowed into the country until 2001. 2000.
Do you know any stories from what it was like during a hyperinflation period?
Yeah, people become quite protectionist. People actually have to be very survival orientated. And with hyperinflation plus sanctions on your country means that you have to become very,
time preference.
You're not high in time preference, but you have to survive, and you have to create your own little local economies to survive and stuff. So people in Serbia ended up becoming quite self-sufficient in that way.
What, bartering or?
Yeah, bartering, selling, finding ways of getting other products into the country, you know, and that still exists today. So
how does it work in a hyperinflating economy with wages? Do people put wages up every week?
Or something? I get told story that you'll get in a hyperinflating economy, you get paid on a Friday, you get paid every week, you get paid on a Friday in the morning, and then by the afternoon, you can't afford the groceries anymore.
Yeah, but so how does it work? Yeah. Like, are employers constantly, is the government putting their wages up every week or something?
Yeah.
They are?
Yeah.
Right. I don't know.
And it's an absolute mess.
Of course. I mean, it's the most destructive.
The most destructive thing ever, yeah.
Yeah. Apart from an actual all-out war, I think.
And you'll find that people will do everything to try and leave the country, but then they'll try and close down the borders and stuff. But yeah, it's an absolute mess. And so you end up having to barter and do other ways to try and get your cash. Mm. I mean, your living.
Mm. Wow. Well, I think, like I say, unless there is anything else, have you got any other aspects of your life? Like, what other things are important?
To me, important is family. Having my son is what helped me change my views on a lot of parts of the world, and also made me more of a monarchist.
Interesting.
Yeah, because
of the longevity.
The longevity of it. It changes you having children. You know, you've got three of yourself.
Yes.
So we're expecting another one later this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. 5-year gap, but hey, a gap is a gap. And
my experience of gaps is I would keep them as small as normal, but better a gap than never.
Exactly.
But yeah, I am agreed with you on. I remember when somebody, before I had kids, somebody told me when you have kids, it changes your ambition in life.
It does.
And it totally did with me. I was very into a career that I cared about, and it's just almost vanished since yep. then. It makes no difference to me either way. It's purely about the, you know, what's happening with my children.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's interesting that it taught you that maybe there's a merit back in being in a monarchic system.
And also it helped me become a maximalist as well. Because I had Bitcoin before he was born, but I was like, you know, into shit coining as well, of course. And then when 2019 and 2020 happened, when you saw those rates going back to zero again, you saw the stimulus going in again, and you start thinking, whoa, actually, this is something up over here. I started studying more about Bitcoin, and I didn't realize I had literally had the keys of the future in my pocket, and I became a maximalist that way. So
does your wife have any interest in Bitcoin?
She has an interest in me that has an interest in Bitcoin.
Okay, that's a common experience.
Yeah, no, but she gets it. I mean, it's hard to explain to her all the things, but she loves like the idea of low time preference. She loves that philosophy, and she gets that because that's family.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's the cornerstone of family.
It is.
The,
yeah.
Right. Well, Philip, thank you for coming in and chatting. It's been
a pleasure, Tim. Like always, good to see you.
Yeah, and you. And good luck with Jan 3 and Orange Pilling of the World. I think, you know, I love this movement like you do, and we see it go from strength to strength every day, which is phenomenal.
It's fantastic. It's great. I think it's a beautiful part of history. You know, we probably have some hard times still ahead of us, but at least some of us are fixing ourselves to then help society.
Amen to that. Well, thanks, Philip, and thanks for coming.
Thanks very much.